time to get onto some more spooky and unusual bits of folklore. And I thought I would just maybe just open it by asking you, in reference to our recent meeting, about things like the Wild Man of Orford, and especially the Nicor, which was a mermaid in Rendlesham, a cannibalistic mermaid. I'd really like to hear about that.
He had a Wild Man of Orford. It's a favourite thing, really. Long ago, there was fishermen out fishing in their boat, pulled in the net, thought they got a really good catch. But when it turned out that there was a chap in there, and he was all covered in seaweed and stuff, didn't speak their language. So they took him in to the port, and Orford in Suffolk, there's a big castle. And so they took him to the boss man at the castle, you know, what do we do with him? And he says, well, it's a bit of a rum, put him in that room there. We'll keep him there for the time being. Back, get him something to eat. Probably eats fish or something. And he's the Wild Man. At this stage, he's not described as having a fishy tail or anything. He's got arms and legs. And anyway, they bring people in to see him. You know, the guards earn a few bob for the honour. But the guy in charge of the castle says, well, you know, it's a bit cruel, really, because he obviously lives in the sea. You know, maybe we should give him a bit of time, you know, out in the water. Put your fishermen's nets out in a big circle and join them up so he can't get away, and we'll let him into there. So that's what they do. And the Wild Man goes into the water, has a nice splash around, and waves to them, and then he swims up to where the next circle is. Waves once more and dives down, and dives so deep he manages to get underneath the net at the bottom. Comes up the other side, surfaces, waves one more time, dives, and that's the last they saw of him. So he's known as the Orford Merman, although, as I say, he hadn't got a tail. Unlike our other East Anglian watery things, we had our own Nessie monster up by Lowestoft, which was seen by the Rider Haggard family.
Oh
But
yeah,
we also
describe
had.
that. What was that one actually? That was more like a sea serpent type.
It was sort of described as a sort of Loch Ness monster sort of thing, but it was at Lowestoft Ness. And there was one or two people saw it, but in Victorian times, the Rider Haggard family who lived at Bungay, which is just on the Suffolk-Norfolk boundary,
Oh yes.
they went out for the day for a picnic on the beach. It was a nice day. Left out of town. And, of course, there's Rider Haggard, the man who wrote She and King Solomon's Mines and so on. And anyway, the rest of the family go out, are on the beach, and Lilias, the daughter, who also eventually ended up as an author, look, and there was this thing swimming out at sea with big coils going up and down like an enormous eel. And so they rushed home and told Dad, who didn't include it in any of his books, surprisingly.
Seems like an opportunity lost.
Given all the other fantastic things he wrote about, you know, Aisha, she who must be obeyed, which is what I normally call my wife.
I is that is that what the Hammer movie is based on? She.
That's right.
That
Yeah,
oh
she lives for like a
really?
thousand years, goes into the flame, but she turns to dust, and the bloke who she's got, he's then stuck with being there for a thousand years.
I
All very
love that
sad.
movie. Great soundtrack as well.
Was it? I can't remember that much.
Yeah, no, I have it. I have it. I have it in the playlist. The soundtrack, because I saw the movie years ago. I discovered the soundtrack and I thought, yes, I remember this. Really,
Well,
really
I saw it in a
beautiful.
teen, and I'm 70 now, so.
Well, there you go. There you go. I didn't see it that long ago. I mean, it was a
It was
repeat of a
probably in
repeat of a
black and
repeat of a
white
repeat.
on a clockwork projector in my days, you know,
Wow.
thing, you know, the light
Wow.
provided by a candle. See, I know these stories because I was there at the time.
Well, you know what? First-hand reports, you know, in the as researchers go, we always prefer first hand account. So if you've got that, then that's good enough for me. So
Well, I haven't necessarily seen these things, but you know, I know the places where they happen, at least, you know, in a southern boy. I mean, we were talking about Nicor, which is the Suffolk freshwater mermaid. And these aren't any like thing like the saltwater mermaids. Yeah, we've got one or two of those, like sort of tales of them. But the saltwater ones, you know, they lure sailors to the rocks sometimes, or whatever, but you know, they're quite romantic in that. The Nicors, the freshwater ones, are just plain nasty and vicious. They've got a rake and they will try and pull you into their pond. There was one in an S-shaped sort of pond at Rendlesham in Suffolk, just near where they've discovered the palace of the Anglo-Saxon King Redwald, in the forest there. And all the local mums would go, "Don't you go near that pond, dear. The Nicor will drag you in." And there's another one which is actually on the golf course at Fordham, just outside Bury St Edmunds.
All Saints, Fornham All Saints.
Yeah. You get different versions of them around the country. The best known one being from the Fens, Jenny Blueteeth, which is a tale that they'll tell you up in the Fens of Lincolnshire. But yeah, why they're so nasty and horrible, I don't know. Maybe it's because they get fed up of swimming around the same old pond, whereas the ones in the sea can go anywhere, can't they?
Perhaps it's to do with there being plenty of fish in the sea and ponds have a little short on protein.
Yeah. I mean, just being stuck on a diet of tadpoles and sticklebacks can't be good.
Exactly. How many tadpoles and sticklebacks does it take to feed a cannibalistic mermaid? And we shall never know. But that's in Rendlesham, one of the mermaid reports anyway, isn't it? And you know, Rendlesham seems to have a lot of tales. There's the Shug monkey as well, which when you mentioned the Wild Man of Orford, reminded me of that report. And tell us about that.
Well, shug monkey is a particularly localized name for Black Shug, the devil dog, who is all around East Anglia, basically following the East Coast, basically from about Maldon direction right up to Yorkshire and York. In most of East Anglia, he's called Black Shug. He's a huge, great black dog with burning red coal eyes, and he's a psychopomp. So if he looks into your eyes with his, you're dead fairly soon after. But he has names like Galley Trot, Hateful Thing, Gear Trash. Up in York, they call him the Bargest. So number of different names, but virtually always the same story: big, big dog, and so on. And the old stories, this one which is at Blythburgh, which is up towards Lowestoft, and in the church there he appeared one Sunday. It was in August, but there was storms rattling about overhead, so they're probably trying to scare off holiday makers, because you know, we like to keep ourselves in the summer. We only have good weather when the tourists aren't here. Anyway, he charges down the aisle of the church, and a couple of people that are in his way that gets caught in sight die. And if you go to the church today, you'll find there is some scratch marks on the door, which is said to be trying to claw to get out. And they're like burnt scratch mark, quite deep. And they're quite high up the door, so you know, it's not something that's bashed into the door or anything. And it would have had to have been a pretty big dog, you know, to have made them at that height, even jumping up. And I'm the owner of a German Shepherd dog, so I know, you know, if our dogs can jump up. On the same day, he also goes to Bungay and goes in the church there, does virtually the same sort of thing. And there was a chap there locally who wrote the thing up. This is in the sort of 1500s, 1600s time. And such was the destruction done in Bungay, the tower of the church was damaged. They had to rebuild the tower, which also, you know, it's a very long time ago. But I used to go to a pub called the Butley Oyster. Butley is out sort of Woodbridge, Orford sort of direction. I used to go there on a Sunday night for a folk singing session years ago, back in the 70s, 80s. And they had a quoits team. Quoits is a particular Suffolk game that you played with big metal discs. And so people used to get in there during the week for that. And there was one old boy who played. And he went into the pub one night and looked absolutely distraught. And somebody said, "What's up with you?" And he said, "Oh," he says, "I just know we'll be bike down to the pub," because the pub was at the bottom of a very steep hill. And this old boy, he more had the bike to keep him steady, you know, for walking rather than riding on. And this hill's quite dangerous, particularly when it gets ice. The pub has been hit several times. He says he's walking down and sees his big dog coming towards him. And he don't like dogs in general, you know. But he thought, "I'll just keep walking." He says, and the dog went straight through me.
Wow.
And, you know, everybody just decided, somebody said, "Oh, that must be Black Shuck." And you go, "Well, you know, what's the proof of that?" Well, the proof of the locals is what happened next, which was a bit of a laugh. But there was a chap in the pub who I knew from the Sunday nights who never bought anybody else a drink. And if he could manage it, not even buy his own. You know, he'd gotten somebody into buying him one. And he said, "You look proper queer, mate. I'll get you a brandy." And
Goodness.
everybody said that was the proof, you know. If he bought him a brandy, the guy must have been really
He
bad for it.
validated the tale with his
And
unexpected
that's not the
generosity.
end to it. That's not the end to it, because 2 years later, just near Leiston, there's a place called Leiston Abbey, which is a ruined abbey. And they wanted to extend the kitchen there because it's used as a sort of music school and so on nowadays. And when they were digging to extend the building, they found in the grounds a skeleton of a dog, of an absolutely huge dog. They actually thought to start off with it was a pony. It was that big, but
Wow,
no,
that
all the
big.
jaws and everything, the bones, was a dog. And they reckon that if it was just trotting along, its head would have been about 7 foot from the ground. And that's a dog skeleton. And about 5 or 10 years ago, reported in the local press and actually nationally as well. So was that Black Shuck? We don't know, but what the hell else was it if not, you know? And curious place for it to be buried as well, because you know the graves for the abbey for people were not in that area at all.
Could it have been buried on holy ground, so to speak, by somebody
Well, it
who
might be. I
found it
don't
or
know.
killed it?
Because the abbey had
Somebody's.
actually moved there, because the original abbey, you can see the ruins of it out at Eastbridge. Eastbridge is near to the coast, and the land that Eastbridge is on is mainly marshy. In fact, it used to have, well, it still has got a wind pump to pump the marsh out. But before that, when they had a little abbey there and just a few monks and so on, they used to get flooded quite often. So they actually moved inland to Leiston, where we have some other land to do that. I love Eastbridge. It's best. You can get to it from the Mindmere Bird Reserve, the RSPB Bird Reserve, on the beach along the coast, and walk through past the old Abbey ruins into Eastbridge. And it's an area where jack-o'-lanterns are reported, you know, the little glowing lights that come up above the
Yes.
marsh. And they're the really serious-minded among you will say, "Oh, it's the marsh gas burning off." But people in the past used to think it was some sort of spirit trying to lead you from the straight and narrow path, you know, which I suppose
It's.
people could have mistook and thought, "Oh, that's the house with the light on, you know,
Yeah.
headed for it," and bloop, down they went.
Into the marsh. Is this the same concept as a will-o'-the-wisp?
Same sort of thing. We call them jack-o'-lanterns in this area, but they got different names around the country. But It's generally jack-o'-lanterns.
Suffolk seems to me to be just a very, very mysterious county. You have things like the Black Shook, the Wild Man of Orford, these Nicor sea serpents, and you've also got things like UFO sightings in Rendlesham as well. This Rendlesham area seems to
Yes.
be an area of high strangeness. Now, what do you
Yeah.
think that
Funnily
is?
enough, I mean, I used to go sleeping, camping overnight in the woods where the Rendlesham UFO sighting
Really?
was supposed to happen. When I just like to go off to the woods every now and again by myself, away from everything. And I used to have a lodger at the time. And I used to say, yeah, that's where I'm going. I'll be back tomorrow. I'll not, send out a search party. And there was actually a sort of ramshackle lean-to shelter against one of the trees with some bits of timber and ferns and that. And I just used to, patch that up, light myself a little fire and make myself a drink, maybe smoke something exotic. And actually, what I'd normally done was get up at about 2 in the morning and go and see the deer because there's a huge herd of deer in the woods, and if you approach them from the right side, you could get quite close to them, if you're downwind of them. But the UFO sighting, I'm no expert on UFOs, but what I can tell you is when I was younger, I used to be a sales rep for AP Foods, the peanut people,
Oh,
but
yes.
and used to call on the bases for that. But before then, I was a planning engineer for post office telephones, as it was in those days back in the 70s, and used to look after the air bases for their telephone needs and planning cable. And Bentwaters Base, which is the American base near there, is one of the last bases that servicemen came to. They would go off when they were enlisted and go off to foreign parts and so on. But Bentwaters was thought to be quite a nice number in England, and they would come back, and nobody really got promoted there much because most of them had already reached, the maximum that they were going to get to, Master Sergeant or whatever it was. And then from Bentwaters, they would go back home to America, and, in a couple of months at a camp in America or whatever would be demobbed and go back into Tivy Street. Well, the report of the UFO in Rendlesham Forest, I don't know too much about it, so I don't know too much about UFOs, but what I do know is that three people who were in that party afterwards, one of them was promoted to Master Sergeant, which was a surprise for him, let alone the others around him. One managed to come out of the USAF early. He wanted to go back to the States because his family weren't great. They'd said no, but suddenly they said, yeah, all right, we'll let you demob early. And the third one of them got a posting abroad to Cyprus, which was thought to be a really nice posting, and so on. But you didn't normally go from Bentwaters to Cyprus, but he'd been angling for somewhere in the sun and he'd got a few more years to do. And he got that. So it seems as if they got through the people who might have spilt the beans out of the way. And I don't know much about the UFO thing, but what I do know is that was really unusual. And I dealt with USAF there for, a dozen years or more in different ways, and used to dine
Okay.
with the officers and all sorts. So,
So, I mean,
yeah.
there definitely is, no smoke without fire, so to speak. And whoever it was that saw it was sort of shipped out as quickly as possible, either to a better situation or a better
Yeah.
position. That
Yeah.
is interesting.
And some people say, well, was it a secret American or British aircraft that nobody admitted to? We don't think so, because it weren't the right sort of base to have them. When I was on telephones, I was security cleared to go into all the secure areas because I had to be. And there was nothing that I saw that was untoward. Whereas I know on some other bases, what's aircraft and weapons that they weren't supposed to have, official and so on. Lakenheath used to have the Blackbird, which the American government denied actually existed for so many years until somebody stood up in their government and said, "Well, if it doesn't exist, how come I can get a plastic model of it made by someone in the local store?" Which was based on pictures that people had taken. So these, those things do happen.
So the entrepreneurs, once again, they make the reveal. Their model making exposed the fact that there was a base there, which is
And
very
so
funny.
it was actually somebody in their parliament that stood up
That's
and
very
actually
funny.
produced the box in his hand. Because
There you
the thing
go.
was, it wasn't that they didn't want their senators to not know about the aircraft. It was to know about the aircraft, they got to know how it was funded, and there was no official funding for it.
That kind
And
of
so
reminds me of
they
those
had to
old Looney
reveal
Tunes
where they got
cartoons.
the funding to develop an aircraft that cost billions and millions of
There you
dollars.
go. And some local villager put up a flashing sign, evil scientist, secret lair right here. Well, look, I think it's fascinating. And when we met, recently for the filming for the Weird Britain TV series, I was really, really taken in by all of this ancient history that Suffolk has and these mysteries as well. And I know that we looked at the Sutton Hoo collection and I got very interested in Saxon history in general. And the reason for
Well,
that was.
it's my sort of subject because I've been an Anglo-Saxon envoy reenactor for 30 years. I write and lecture and research. I'm doing some research for another book at the moment. So I've got a deep interest, spent years and years reenacting at Sutton Hoo, which, if you're an Anglo-Saxon reenactor, it's the best place in the world to do reenactment. I had the pleasure of doing some experimental archaeology there and all. But of course, there wouldn't be Sutton Hoo if it wasn't for the lady who owned the land originally back in the 30s, believing in ghosts.
Oh,
Because,
really? Well, how did that help her discover Sutton Hoo?
well, Mrs. Pretty was the lady that owned Tranmer House, which is the house that you see as you come into the Sutton Hoo site. And she stayed single for many years because she looked after her aged parents, and she wasn't going to get married until after they died and so on. Anyway, like many people in the 30s, she was interested in spiritualism and so on. And one of her friends said that she thought she'd seen the ghosts of some soldiers, which she thought might be Roman soldiers, marching across where the mounds were when the mist were. You get a lot of mists in Suffolk and, rising from the ground and so on. And she knew that she'd got some mounds down there, away from the house. And so she got in a guy called Basil Brown, to do an experimental dig on one. And he done a little dig on one, and then he went on to Mound One, which was where the ship had been buried with all the fantastic treasure, which in the British Museum now, the most fabulous treasure ever found in Great Britain, and so on. And of course, over the years, the other mounds that have been explored of that. A lot of them were robbed in antiquity, but Mound One, the robbers had actually missed the burial chamber because the sides of the mound had got carved off by ploughing. So when they went down in what they thought was the middle of the mound, it wasn't. They were about 6 foot out. If they'd have gone 6 foot to one side, they'd have found it all. And poor Basil
Oh,
Brown
lost
wouldn't
it
have.
completely.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't a trained archaeologist, but he was really, really good. And some of the archaeologists back in the 30s weren't that brilliant. They'd been to university, but their practical training was pretty bad and their recording was quite bad. You go back on Basil Brown's notebooks, and you'll find he's recorded when they dug down, his measurements were exact, and he's only using, tape measures and sticks and things, and got the GPS markers and
What
things
was
that they
his
had.
background? Was he an engineer or something?
Because he got shoved out by, archaeologists from Oxford and Cambridge who ended up the thing over. But he's the bloke we all remember and who done one hell of a job,
Absolutely. I mean, having seen that, what the replicas of that treasure and the mounds, it's hard to really understand how anybody could have guessed where to even start digging. And they're not as impressive visually as you would imagine them to be, these mounds.
Yeah, and of course, we've just heard news that there's going to be another dig at Sun who this summer. I think I told you at the time that there's actually two cemeteries there. Most people don't realize about the first cemetery. The main cemetery, there's about 18 mounds, which has kings and queens and princes buried there in these mounds, which you'd have seen as you come up the River Deben. So that'd have been very impressive. Look, you're entering the kingdom of the Wuffings dynasty. You know, watch your step, Sonny Jim, because we've got the power to stick all these big mounds up. But where the restaurants is and the little field behind that, it was known that they'd found some remains of some earlier graves there, and they virtually petered out in about 550, just as the mounds were getting going, and they were more ordinary people that were found. Anyway, they've never excavated the whole thing, and this summer they're getting together with Time Team and everything, and they're going to excavate the rest of it, which means it's a busy old place. Because going back to Rendlesham again, of course, Rendlesham was always the place reckoned to be the palace of the king, founder Sun, who Redwald and his ancestors and so on.
Oh,
And
really?
I've worked over the last 3 years a little bit to do with the dig that was done on Rendlesham when they've actually found the main hall that was used, which is a huge place. That's really fantastically, at the end of last summer, they found the temple, which it was always said by the Venerable Bede that he had a temple there, which he set up a Christian altar next to his pagan ones because he couldn't see why he shouldn't. And they've actually found it. It's only about the third that's ever been found in Britain of that dating.
Wow.
And it's on private ground, but unfortunate because I had private access to it, that I actually got to see where the post holes were and so on.
I mean, that's really fantastic. And it reminds me of a situation that I was discussing recently about where we get our sort of background folklore from. Because of course, at some point further in the past, this place would have been ruled by the Romans and inhabited primarily by the Britons, who had their own culture, and later Saxons and the Angles and everybody else came across and brought their mysteries and folklore, things like black shooks and other things. Do you think, from your experience, that black shook type animals and other similar folklore is that is that a sort of an Anglo-Saxon sort of
Well, I've got a little theory, and I can't prove it, but the reports of Black Shook and all the other names that he's known by are either along the coast or only a few miles inland, yeah, from Maldon up to Yorkshire. He's never normally reported anywhere inland. And we know that when the Vikings come across and were doing their raids and then later on invading, that obviously they came in by ship, and they would have used the coastal paths and so on. But they've got to look out for villages getting uppity and attacking them back. Now, they had their system of magic, like everyone else, and of course, they stayed pagan for a lot longer than the Anglo-Saxon. So, why shouldn't they send out a filger, a fetch, in the shape of a big dog? There's plenty of big dogs and wolves and that within the Norse mythology. You look at the creation and destruction story of Ragnarok, which I'm writing about at the moment, and researching, you know, there's
Fenrir and have
various
that
ones.
kind
So
of
it would be an
symbolism.
obvious thing, send one of those out in front of you, scare the crap out of people out of the way, and leave it free to, you know, so that you can find an innocently sleeping village somewhere.
That makes a lot of sense because, of
Yeah,
course, this
can't
would
prove it,
be.
but you know that it's as good a possibility as any. And why hasn't it gone inland? You know, it doesn't. Most folklore things, you know, do go a little bit inland. Some of them get different names, you know, but
They spread.
to not have that inland. I mean, there's a thing on the fens which spreads from the fens in Suffolk up into Norfolk, over into Lincolnshire here, and into Cambridgeshire, which is a thing called the Green Mist, and you get versions of it right across. And the Green Mist comes up in winter, and it's basically a sort of an intelligence of the fen when it all goes dead in winter. And it's quite a spooky story about a lass, and she's living in one of these little fen villages with, three people and a dog or whatever, and she's bored with it, teenaged or whatever. And she says to her mum, "Oh, I'm bored. So miserable and wet and damp. Half the people around here have got arthritis and bronchitis and things, I wish summer would come." The mother says, "Hush, don't say that. The Green Mist knows. You never disparage the winter. It's necessary for the growing season and everything else for each season in its time." And so soon after, she falls ill. And she's in bed, can hardly move. Mum tries to tempt her with a little food and so on. And as she gets a little bit better, she sits in the window looking out the window, hoping, to see the buds breaking forth and things like that. And there's a young man who comes by each day on his way to work on one of the dikes on the fens, because back in the 15, 1600s, a lot of the fens were drained to make agricultural land. Some of the guys were Dutch, the engineers, but they employed British workmen. Anyway, this chap looks up and waves to her on his way by, and she gets to look forward to this chap going by twice a day, giving her a wave, and then it gets a bit more, and they chat a little. And he says, well, not very strong, But he persuades her to go out for a little walk and so on. And she said, "Well, I can only go slowly and not too far because I'm still quite weak, But the spring is coming and the sun is starting to get through." And they go for a walk, and he says, "Oh, hang on, you be going on. I'll catch her up in a moment. I just want to do my shoelace up." And, but as she goes on, he's seen some of the first spring flowers, and he picks them for her, takes them up to her. When she sees them, she realises what he's done, because they're the fen, particular fen flowers. And she collapses there and dies.
Goodness.
Because it's when the Green Mist sends the new flowers, those who doubted that they would ever come don't get to live to see them.
Aren't they amazing? These superstitions that we all have in every single culture, but the ways in which they manifest themselves in every culture really interest me. And especially, as we said, with the spread of the Anglo-Saxons and then later the Vikings into these areas, what superstitions were there that they brought with them that we now hold today as our own? I was thinking recently of the Duende legend in Portugal and Spain, and how it's also, you find it in the Philippines and Latin America as well. And of course, we can't assume that the conquistadors imported some invasive species over to the Americas. Clearly, that they inherited the legends from the colonizers, and in a lesser way, we've inherited them, or a less clear way, we've inherited them from, mainland Europe and, the Romans, the Angles, the Saxons, the
We've been invaded
Vikings.
by everybody. We're all a bunch of mongrels, basically. You know, I know my DNA, and it's got about a dozen different countries
Same, same.
in it. My family has been in Suffolk for 400 years, on all four lines of my family. But I can tell you, I'm a royal mongrel when it comes to my DNA.
But isn't that strange? There's something very, and I know Europe is a melting pot in a way as well, but there's much more pedigree in lots of the European nations than there is in ours because of that. And somehow I've always felt like it's made us kind of hardy, As they say, when the dog is mixed,
Yeah.
it'll last kind of thing. It'll be tough.
Well,
It'll
it's
have
always
stamina. It'll
that
live
thing
long.
about do people really invade us and boss us around, or do they get assimilated to us,
I think it's a
And I
second one,
think some
personally.
people, I mean, the Normans did do that, and they rode roughshod over everything. But the Romans became quite anglicised when they were here and married local women and started worshipping our local gods instead of their own. The Saxons brought their stuff with us, but we know they married Celtic women who were, the people who were here before the Brythonic races and so on, and seem to adopt some of their customs and some of their jewellery, and also some of the old Roman jewellery as well. It wasn't really in, and then the Vikings come, and of course the Vikings, who are Norwegians and Danes and so on, are sort of related to the Anglo-Saxons anyway. They both come from the same Germanic area, the sort of Danube Delta or something, the Rhine Delta, and so on. So they got pretty much the same mythology, or with a few pronunciation shift from Odin to Woden and things like that, and I think there's some things that travel like that, and there's some things that are invented, and you'll think, well, that's similar to here, and there does it has it come to them. But having said that, if I say go and invent a ghost story, what time of day would you invent it at? Night time, obviously, because it's always dark is always better, isn't it? So you'll get similar aspects in stories that have grown up simultaneously. And you do wonder sometimes how these things spread. In East Anglia, we've got wood woes, which I've written about, which are a type of green men, but with arms and legs on a club, as well as the regular green men. But I read a book years ago by Mike Hardin, the folky, who'd been to India and was interested in green men and saw them there as well. Because he was going around, he got his days spare before he'd done the gigs in the evening and so on, and saw green man figures in India. There's an
Well,
East Anglian
these
traditional
hairy
ballad.
humanoids, they're worldwide. These representations of some hairy man-like creature, whatever people think it is, it's a worldwide thing.
Who knows, the wood woes, is he the same as the Sasquatch or the Yeti
Yes,
or
that's
the
the big question.
Bigfoot or whatever? Oh, but never find out. I like these things to remain a mystery, really. I mean, I like the fact, that we've got this Loch Ness monster. I don't know whether it exists or not. I hope it does, but I also hope that nobody ever finds it. It spoils it.
It's strange you should say that, actually, because I've met a lot of people that think the same way, and I used to think differently. That more and more as time goes on, I'm starting to think in this way of maintaining the mystery and the wonder. Because let's say the Kraken of old was probably the giant squid, and now we found the giant squid. It's just another regular member of the known fauna
Yeah,
of the
but
world. It's
we need a bit of
impressive.
mystery and magic in our lives. We really
Yes.
do, and if everybody knew where the elves lived or something or other, somebody'd set up a McDonald's and a car park and a,
Gift shop. A gift shop at the Elf Hill. Gosh, there's something else I wanted to talk to you about. And I know that you're a prolific author, and you sent me this great book called Pagan Paths. And I don't know a lot about paganism. I encountered the variation of it recently when I was in Avebury and I was at the Gorset, and I thought they'd all be druids, these guys, and then I found out that they were Wiccans and witches and Norse pagans and neo-pagans and
Well,
modern pagans and
most pagan paths get together, and get on with each other very well indeed. They set quite a good example for the religious world, really. You think, if you think something like Christianity, big amorphous thing, but there's lots of divisions in it. You know, there's Catholics and Methodists and Baptists and
Yeah, that's
Jehovah's
so,
Witnesses
yeah.
and that, all different variations, and they don't always get on terribly well. We do, or despite we've got differences. You know, I'm a heathen, so I sort of follow the Anglo-Saxon and
Okay.
Norse Viking stuff. But I get on very well with the Celts and the witches and the druids and the shaman and so on. In fact, we all go to the same camps, we go to the same conferences and concerts and so on, and have a good time together. And part of it is not because we all want to be the same, it's because we quite admire each other's differences, and we're allowed to be different because there's no one big authority saying, "Oi, you've got to do this," or "Oi, you mustn't do that." We haven't got a pope, we haven't got an imam, we haven't got a Bible. You know, we've got no one text that says, "Do it like this or do it like that," which means as a pagan, you really have to find your own way. And, you know, if you get three pagans, well, you've got five opinions anyway, you know, because, you know, it's very personal, you know, and nobody can tell you know, really what to do. You can take advice from others and say, well, what works for you? And if it sounds good, then maybe adopt it. But, you know, so people draw from all those things, and some people known as eclectics draw from a little bit from several traditions, you know. I go around and lecture at these camps and conferences. I've been doing it for 20, 30 years now, I suppose. Go and flog me books and so on. And always very good natured things. And yes, we'll have some quite fierce discussions at the time, but it's with respect, you know. Because if you're trying to decide, you know, what you want to do as a pagan, the only thing you can do is like discuss it with others, you know, or what color candles do you use, you know, or something like that. Because that's the only way you're going to work it out. But we sort of celebrate our sort of uniqueness. But it does mean that paganism isn't the ideal spiritual path for lots of people, because it's not presented on a plate for you. You know, there's nobody telling you what to do. You've got to work it out for yourself. It's a sort of spiritual path with homework, I suppose.
But I
And
said,
inevitably, there's some pagans who are activists and write and lecture and lead groups and all that sort of thing. And
yeah.
there's some pagans who are basically, well, I think I'm vaguely pagan, but you know, that's enough. I don't necessarily do a lot about it. And they'll basically hold the sort of general beliefs of, you know, nature is very special, that, you know,
Philosophical pagans, you're saying in a way, and
nature
yeah,
religions, you know, they're all
okay.
secret triads, really.
Got it. Yeah, got it.
And that we believe in lots of gods and goddesses, not just one. You know, so there's a feminine divine as well as a male divine. Some pagans think that there's just the air. Some think that, you know, and all the rest are sort of aspects of them. And some people believe, no, the whole lot, they're all different. So yeah, they're the two main things. And the other thing is, you know, not to harm people deliberately and so on. Most religion really at their base says be nice to each other, be nice to children, don't they? You know, if they were stuck to that, then we'd do a lot better. The peculiar thing about paganism is it's the one religious path that deliberately will not proselytize. You know, we think it's really bad to go and try and convert anybody to our path because it's not suitable for everybody, so it'd be irresponsible. We'll answer
Okay, that's
questions, you know.
interesting.
But despite that, despite the fact that we're the only lot that can go and try and convert people, if you look at the census for the last two censuses in England, Wales, Scotland, so on, you find that the biggest increase is amongst the pagan groups. You know,
Is
there's
it
more of us
really?
than, yeah, there's more of us than Buddhists, for instance, you know,
Wow.
most people know. But of course, people don't always publicise the fact because there is prejudice, you know. against it in some quarters. Could go
Why do you
on.
think that? What are some of the misconceptions that people in the UK might have when
Well, of
you tell
course, I
them?
got, oh yeah, the misconception. Well, of course, I got in the Naked Virgins on the old way,
Oh, okay. So
and the
it's
human
like devil
sacrifices.
worshippers or something. Okay.
But I've sadly found that that doesn't happen. I must have joined the wrong groups or something. I mean, the big thing
Still
is, well,
searching, huh?
no, that's a joke, but took it seriously. Of course, the church demonized it by saying you're all devil worshippers. We're not. The devil, as far as we're concerned, is a Christian invention, and we don't have nothing to do with it, But you find out with most religions around the world that when the big new religion comes in, they'll call gods of the old religion devils. So no, we're not devil worshippers. There are devil worshippers about, but they're not what we would count as pagans, and they're very few and far between and tend to be spotty adolescent youths without sex life, very few I've ever met.
It's funny actually because I was in Cornwall and a witch guy in there told me a story, and in his shop he had sort of a satanic Bible, and I said, how did you get that? And a sacrificial knife, and he said, well, a witch friend of mine was in the forest at night with a hood on, cutting herbs for a ceremony, and he had a candle and he left it somewhere while he went to get the herbs. And he came back and he thought he saw his candle in the distance, and he walked up still with his knife in his hand to where he thought his candle was, and here was some young lad leaning over this satanic Bible with a knife, trying to raise the devil, I'm guessing, and saw him, and he forgot he had his hood on, screamed and ran off, leaving the
Oh,
Bible and the knife in the forest, which I thought was really funny because
hoods and cloaks are wonderful things. Let me tell you one of my own experience, all right? One time I ran a coach trip from Chelmsford, where I was working at the time, down to Stonehenge, Avebury, the area around there for pagans from the Chelmsford area, and we filled up a coach, basically. And the idea was we'd have a look around Stonehenge during the day, like ordinary visitors. Then we went off to Avebury and looked around there, and we looked at Tilbury Hill. Sort of different pagan sites. But I've obtained private entry into Stonehenge for when the public left. It should have been 6 o'clock. And it costs quite a lot of money, and you have to sign a book of forms, sort of like a telephone directory. Do they have them still, telephone directories? I don't know.
No, I don't.
Anyway, with Eagle of
Maybe.
Cheritage and so on. And I said beforehand, look, do you want to do any ordinary clothes, or do you want to wear robes? And they said, oh, no, let's take off robes, yeah, or not. So we took robes and cloaks and things, because one couple were going to wanted to name their baby in the middle of Stonehenge, and another couple wanted to take a hand fasting oath, sort of thing. So we think, well, yeah. So we got off the bus and so on, put cloaks, robes, whatever on, ready for 6 o'clock. But inevitably, the visitors were slow leaving. It was a nice day, And the lady who was in charge said, we've got to count all your. We've got to wait for them all to get out, and we've got to count your people in. We'll have to count them out again afterwards. And you mustn't play amplified music or brass or anything like that. And yeah, we know that. So eventually she said, right, yours can go in it. And she probably knows there's an under sort of tunnel underneath the road that goes into Stonehenge.
Yes.
And so we count them in, and this lady's got a clipboard and everything. And it's just me and a chap called Arthur. Waiting to be given the final go. And I said to the party, look, if you go down there, get yourselves in a nice calm frame of mind, a bit of quiet, we've had a bit of a laugh, but let's get serious, remember where we are, and so on. It's sacred to many people, and so on. Anyway, there were two American tourist guys sitting up just above where the tunnel was, and they were festooned with cameras and And one of them called down and said, "Hey, gee, are you a couple of those druids?" Well, I looked up, pulled me a hood over and said, "Oh, don't steal our spirits." Me and Arthur ran for the tunnel and doubled up in laughter underneath the tunnel, wondering what sort
Goodness.
of tale they would take home to America.
Your
Eventually,
spirits have
some of
probably
our
been
party,
sold on eBay somewhere since.
eventually some of our party come back and said, "Come on, we're waiting for you." We were sort of still snickering, couldn't stop giggling. And I was like, "Yeah, well, as soon as we've calmed down, we
Oh
will."
my goodness.
And then we went in and had a very, very nice time. Yeah, the power of wearing a robe or a cloak has people's heads in sometimes.
Well, you know what? I was in Edinburgh, what's it called? Greyfriars Kirk,
Oh,
last
yes, I
summer,
know. Yeah,
and
Crowfowl's Bobby and all that.
I was interviewing some guy about a comedian actually about the history of the graveyard. And similarly, a tourist just walked up in the middle of the interview and said, "Hey, what are you guys, talking about? What you're doing here?" And I said, "This man is a suspected serial killer, and we've come here to make a documentary about him in the graveyard where he's said to have buried all of his victims, and he's going to attempt to prove to us that, it wasn't him,
Yeah.
he didn't kill them." And the guy went, "Oh, okay," and kind of stepped back really
Yeah,
slowly and backed off. And I thought, okay, that wasn't clearly a very obvious joke. But for next
but
time, the next time.
you wonder what people make of things years later, don't you? I mean, I used to do this thing. I've always been involved in the folk world, and one of the things I used to do each year for May Day was get up very early. In the morning, go down to Felixstowe in Suffolk on the coast and be the green man for East Suffolk Morris when they danced up the sun, because lots of Morrisides dance up the sun on May Day morning.
Do they?
What they didn't actually know, really, was the fact that my pagan group actually made this green man structure the day before and we brought it to life within a circle. So, and we went to a place. Excuse me a minute. Went to a place called Acton Shores, just outside Ipswich, and got some greenery, which just before May is sometimes, depending on what the year has been like, it's quite difficult to find the leaves and that, got more twigs. And got a framework of sort of chicken wire and stuff. And made it. And of course, I sort of crawled into it and brought it to life. So this bit of woodland that runs along the River Orwell is quite narrow and it's used by cyclists, fishermen, dog walkers, all sorts. So you can never get too far away from, other humans sort of thing. But it was a fairly quiet time. But just as I got into the Green Man and was standing up and sort of dancing around a bit, along comes a little boy who was with a family, and he got a bit ahead of them, and they were down on the beach, but he'd come up onto the grassy path, and he sort of stopped and then carried on. So little later on, we packed up and we put this structure in a big sack thing to carry it away so it didn't leave leaves in the car, and rubbish, ready for the next morning for May Day. And we saw this little boy with his family, and he was talking very earnestly to him. We couldn't hear what he was saying, but we got the basic drift that he was saying there's a bush that goes and dances about. What he's saying, shut up, you little liar, But what in 20 years' time will he think? My parents didn't believe me, but what did I
I
really
saw
see there that day?
the dance in the
And
bush.
so I used to get up and dance with it for the Morris men. And it's funny because, we think about masks and hoods and things like that. Now, every one of the Morris men knew that it was me inside the framework, and they invited me to take part each year. Now, ordinarily, if I went into the pub where East Suffolk Morris go after a practice or a dance out. He'd be, hello, your old Tosser Jennings, you know, for amount of revolver, you know. But just that morning, they, you know, got out of their cars and came over and started putting their Morris gear on. Little bow, good morning, green man. The utmost motorist fan. And sometimes we stand and they watch the Morris men dance, you know, dance the sun up. And inevitably, at sort of half past 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, there's not many people turn up to watch it, but the only people who do are the sort of wives and girlfriends. And, you know, maybe one of them would edge up close to me and just pinch a leaf from my coat, put it in a handbag or pocket. And I wouldn't say anything, and they wouldn't say anything. But I think, oh, yeah, they've been married a couple of years, probably fine for a family now.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's what they're doing?
Yeah, and I never said anything, they never said anything. Oh, yeah, most of these people, they're BT engineers, they're accountants, lawyers, you know, teachers. And if you send Pagan to them, I go, what, them a weird lot, you know, Morris people thinking that they're not as weird as anybody else. And yet there was that little bit of superstition that the green man, you know, sort of fertility figure.
That is
done that for years.
Mention,
I don't know.
That.
I've retired from it now. But
no, of course. Yeah, you got to be careful there that you don't, the leaves don't affect you as well, and you end up with, you know, 12 kids.
Funnily enough, every year that I've done it, although I'd been up the night before with my Pagan group, making it and bringing it to life, then up really early in the morning to go down to Felixstowe and, you know, dance up the sun. Always afterwards, I really felt very invigorated, would sort of be in the mood for doing little practical jokes and things. And it has to be said, Randy.
Okay, so all of your kids are basically conceived on May Day. That's what you're telling me.
No, but
yeah. I can tell you a funny fact, actually, about my, I have two children, and they both originally, although they were born on different dates, had the same, exactly same prospective date of birth given by the doctors when my wife was found to be pregnant. Both were supposed to be born on the 21st of June. And one was born 2 weeks before, and the other was born the day afterwards. But I don't know how we managed to get exactly the same day both times in a row, but we did. You know.
Well, I know exactly when I was conceived. Now, my birthday is 26th of September. And if you look back 9 months, that takes you to the 26th of December, Boxing Day, which my father was working away right up till Christmas Eve, and had 2 days off and then had to go back to work after that. Now, I was obviously a Boxing Day mistake because I arrived about 6 years after my next nearest sibling. You know, I'm the youngest, and they're all 6, 8, 10 or 12 years older than me.
Oh, there you go,
and so on. But yeah, I was the Boxing Day mistake.
Exactly
9 months later, I was born. And in fact, there's a thing about that a little bit that I mentioned to you. You ever heard of a chime child?
No.
No? Well, if you look up the 26th of September, 1953, which is when I was born, you'll find it was a Saturday. Okay, no, I didn't know that originally. I found out this later. But something I remember when I was little, you know, when you're a kid and adults sometimes say something and you pick it up when you're not meant to,
you know,
with big flappy ears. I was round my great aunt Ginny's, one lovely lady, and she said something. I was probably only about 5 years old, I suspect. And she said something, oh, bless him, little dear, but there is a chime child. My mother said, quiet, don't talk in front. Now, my mother was a superstitious person, but she was very rational and clever in others. But anyway, I never thought, never asked me mum what it meant or anything. Fast forward to me being about, I don't know, 21, 22 years of age. going into Ipswich Central Library and was looking amongst the books on folk song and folk traditions.
Yes.
I'm interested. And there on the shelf was a little book by a lady called Ruth Tong called The Chime Child. Oh, wow, I remember that phrase and got it out.
Yeah.
And she had been brought up in the New Forest area and was reckoned to be a chime child, which the book said was between midnight on Saturday and cockcrow for. Yeah, midnight on the Friday night and cockcrow on the Saturday morning. Yeah. So, between about 12 and 6 or whatever. And a chime child, you could tell them secrets and they'd keep it, but they were a bit canny. They were the one most likely to see a ghost or, have a little bit of arcane knowledge and so on. So, reading this in his book, I was, oh, God. But this is New Forest, we're Suffolk, we're not New Forest. But anyway, I checked up and found that yes, I was born on a Saturday morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, which would have put me, within that time frame. And then 10 years later, found that the idea of a chime child did exist in Suffolk as well. In fact, it's recorded in a couple of places. It's not a well-known thing. But for some reason,
Very interesting.
it found its way into my family. And of course, it was accurate because I've always been into the sort of uncanny things and
Well, she could
folklore.
see it back then, your aunt,
Well,
so.
yeah, but birth through, it was the following day. When she died, she left me her wind-up gramophone, which, as I later ended up as a disco DJ and done a radio show for 20 years, somewhat appropriate, really. Because when I used to go there, after a while, she'd say, "Oh, get bored. Let's put a record on and play me a funny musical song or something like that." And I ended up with those old 78 records that her wind up gramophone when she died a couple of years later.
Amazing. I mean that's a great gift. I always love stuff from the past. I love how it's made. I love what it shows about where we were socially at that time, the things that we thought and what we valued. Even the children, my children recently took me to an antique store, a very big one, Kingston upon Thames, and it was amazing. They literally had things from every era, and I started to think, this is what people valued in this era. This is what they thought was pretty expensive, fashionable, whatever. And it's amazing. And some of the stuff just looks like really, the worst type of junk you'd never want to see again. And other elements of things were really supremely well created and made. And it was a sense of loss almost that we don't have that now. These wonderful things and
Well, the
jewels
fact
and
that
how they were
children would
made.
probably, even well-to-do children, would have only probably had one or two toys. They wouldn't have had boxes and boxes of them, not unless they
Oh
were very spoiled,
no. I gosh,
And
I we live in a toy
if a
house.
person
Yeah,
has
true.
just one special thing, it really is special to them. I remember meeting a gardener in a garden of a hotel in Tunisia and in the southern part, Dosa, at edge of the desert. And he was a poor man. He lived most of the time in his garden shed in the hotel grounds. And he hadn't got a lot of English, but sat down and talked and pointed to things, and he, oh, the banana tree, or fig tree, or whatever. He felt in the folds of his clothes because he'd got about six layers on to keep the sun out rather and got out this bit of oilskin cloth, which you got a little bag inside it. And inside the little bag was a watch, it was a Timex watch. And I used to have one when I was about 6 or 7 years old. So quite a common one, which got a white face, but like a blue circle and the dial and luminous hands and so on. And he got this watch out and pointed to my watch and compared his watch to mine to see if they were at the same time. And when he realized they were, he was highly delighted and a big grin from ear to ear, But he'd just shown me the most precious thing in his life, I was probably wearing a pair of jeans at would have taken him all year to have saved up for, from his wages.
Yes.
And so if you've only got one thing, then, he's very, very special.
Well, I think
People or
everything in
kids
our
who have too
lives
many
is.
things, they just don't appreciate them half
They
of them.
do. And I always tell the children this. I said, look, I don't want you to feel bad about what other people don't have, but appreciate what you do have, knowing there are people out there who would love to be in your situation.